Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's a scene in the last Indiana Jones movie, director Steven Spielberg's kitschy ode to the nuclear age, where Indiana and a Russian bad guy find themselves on a lit rocket sled. It's a cute scene, one of many historical nods that film had. But today, my guest will tell us the story about the unique doctor who actually built and repeatedly rode that rocket sled, and in the process, radically changed our understanding of the body's ability to absorb G-forces and stresses, and greatly improved all of our safety in the air, underwater, and in our cars. Oh, and he also became the fastest man on Earth. Dr. John Paul Stapp has been called a real-life crash test dummy, but in fact he conducted tests on the limits of the body at speeds surpassing 600 miles per hour and improved human safety by learning how to safely survive high-speed crashes and deaccelerations. Riding a rocket sled called the Sonic Wind, Stapp's research helped design processes that would make an Air Force jet cockpit more survivable in an accident or an ejection, and would later affect all of us by campaigning with Ralph Nader to urge car manufacturers to adopt seat belts and shoulder harnesses, and for Congress to create the National Highway Safety Administration. Nonfiction writer Craig Ryan brings Stapp's story to life in his book Sonic Wind, the story of John Paul Stapp and how a renegade doctor became the fastest man on Earth. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Craig Ryan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.
One of the great insights into history is learning about people who have made a tremendous impact on everyone's lives, yet we don't know the name or we know very little about them. And while Dr. John Paul Stapp is probably very well known within his circles, to the general public, he's probably not well known. And when you think of a lifesaver, Colonel Stapp is among the top in the world for saving lives.
Yeah, I'd say that's right. In fact, I say in the book, and I think it's true, that you can make a pretty strong argument for Stapp having been directly or indirectly responsible for saving more lives in history. I mean, we may be talking upwards of a million people who are walking around who wouldn't otherwise be with us.
This is up there with Jonas Salk and Pasteur and all the other great medical geniuses that we do know, but we don't know who Dr. Stapp is, except for this brief moment. You had his 15 minutes of fame, if you will, in the 1950s.
Well, it's true. That was mid-1950s were Dr. Stapp's celebrity years, but he continued to have an incredible influence right through the end of his life with the work that he did on car crash safety. He was instrumental in the legislation that got passed in the mid-60s that required car companies to begin installing really crucial safety equipment like seat belts and airbags as standard equipment in cars. So even though his celebrity may have tapered off in the 1950s, his influence may have continued to grow right through the 60s and 70s.
Tell us a little bit about Colonel Stapp. Where his fame came from was he was a leader of a team that began looking at how humans would be able to handle a very fast flight, how humans would deal with ejector seats. But his research was really broad. I mean, everything from how pilots who were flying on oxygen way above the 20,000-foot level, how to deal with the problems of those high-altitude flights. You know, just like as if you went diving deep, you were prone to the bends. He figured out how to minimize that risk. He was really quite an amazing doctor.
Well, the implications of Stapp's research, as you say, are broad. I mean, it's really almost hard to grasp everything that he had an influence on. But the focus of his research, and in fact, the focus of his entire life, was on finding ways to protect human beings in vulnerable or even violent situations, such as airplane crashes and car crashes. So everything he did was really focused on that. How do we protect people from injury, and how do we allow human beings to walk away from almost unimaginably violent collisions? So everything was really focused on that, and yet the applications were incredibly broad.
You found a couple of events in his early life, one as a young adult and another when he was still fairly young, of personal tragedy that sort of changed his way of thinking. One was a cousin that threw some newspapers onto an open fire, and he caught on fire, and Stapp always felt like the child did not get anywhere near adequate medical care. That sort of began to change his focus.
Well, that's right. And when you work on a biography like this, you're always looking for the drivers, what forced somebody in the direction that they went in their life. And these two incidents that you mentioned actually both occurred over Christmas holiday 1927 during Stapp's sophomore year at Baylor University. The tragedy with his young cousin who died from the fire that he experienced there, as you described. And then literally just a week later, Stapp's sweetheart, a young woman who he had met at Baylor, with whom he discussed starting a family, they really envisioned the rest of their lives together, she was killed in a car crash in Hollywood, California, just about a week later. And these two events together completely changed the arc of Stapp's life. And he went from someone who had assumed that he was going to follow the path of perhaps being a writer or an actor. Suddenly, those pursuits began to seem trivial to him, and he decided he was going to enroll in the pre-med program. He wanted to become a doctor, and it was, again, all about this notion of trying to figure out how to relieve human suffering and reduce the death and mayhem as a result of violent collisions or even something like a fire.
Now, he had an interesting young life, too. His parents were missionaries. He was born in Bahia, Brazil, and grew up, for the most part, in Brazil and back and forth, right?
He did, and in fact, his parents, who spent their entire careers in Brazil as missionaries, the Southern Baptist missionaries, Stapp, until the age of five, was not allowed to even speak English. His mother required him to speak Portuguese until he reached the age of five, and then Stapp, like his three younger brothers, as they hit the age of about 12 or 13, his parents sent them back to the United States, back to Texas, to finish their education. So his childhood was kind of back and forth between Brazil and Texas.
How did he end up in the Army? He was drafted in the Army or decided to enlist during World War II, or what exactly?
He was in his final year of medical school at the University of Minnesota in 1944 when he was drafted into the U.S. Army Air Corps. And that had never been part of the plan. Stapp's plan had been to get his medical degree and to go into private practice as a pediatrician. But drafted in that final year of World War II, he was stationed all around the United States in various air bases, and got what he described as the best survey course in medicine any doctor could ever get. And he came out of that experience as an extremely well-rounded medical man and medical researcher. And his life, again, went a different direction.
And how did he wind up doing aeronautical research or aeronautical medical research? That's where he made his career. He began looking at serious problems that the Air Force was having. At that point, it was still the Air Corps at that time. But as the war was winding down, you know, you had B-29s that were flying very, very high. You had pilots that were subject to the bends. There were all sorts of issues as this technology was really exceeding the natural barriers man has always had. This technology was exceeding those barriers.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's a common thread through the development of technology. The technology always precedes our ability to deal with it and to protect ourselves. Stapp, you have to remember, in addition to his medical doctor degree, he had a Ph.D. in biophysics from the University of Texas. And so when he was assigned to right field after the final years of World War II, he suddenly found himself in position to use all of his intellect and all of his training on some of these really, at that time, fairly exotic aeromedical problems. How do you protect a pilot who ejects from a speeding aircraft? How do you protect pilots that are going to extreme altitudes? There were so many problems that the Army Air Corps was rushing to try to solve. It was just it was very rich ground for Stapp. He had a lot of opportunities, and the biggest one came when he was given an assignment to run his own project that was out at Muroc Army Air Base in the Mojave Desert in California, to try to figure out how to devise restraint systems for pilots ejecting from high-speed and high-altitude aircraft. And that was just a perfect situation for Stapp. Had his own research project. He could really dig in and run it the way he wanted to.
Yeah, it was really interesting. You know, you think of the ejector seat as sort of a natural byproduct and this actually first came from captured German documents, in which Germans were using, well, as the Germans were wont to during World War II, they were using prisoners as test subjects with some hideous results. But they were already experimenting with ejector seats towards the end of the war. And it seems like a natural idea, but nobody knew what the effect on the body would be from ejecting from an airplane that was moving 300, 400, 500 miles an hour.
Well, the Germans were ahead of the Americans all through World War II on development of aviation and new wrinkles. And the ejection seat was something that the United States didn't have. Ejection seats were actually captured from the Germans after the war and brought back to Wright Field to be reverse engineered by our aeromedical men. And so this is perfect setup for staff, because it's one thing to eject from an airplane if you're going 300-400 miles an hour, but what happens when you're going Mach 1 plus and you eject from an aircraft? That's an incredible biomechanical force on the human body to be going 650-700 miles an hour and suddenly be shot out of the airplane. It's like hitting a wall. Staff had a lot of unique ideas on how he was going to solve the problem of protecting that pilot. One of the really interesting things he did, having been exposed to what the Germans had done, and as you said, they used prisoners to test these kinds of things, Stapp decided rather than using volunteers, he would put himself into the middle of these experiments, and he would do the experiments on himself. And it was something that kind of horrified the Air Force at the time, but it was an incredibly valuable move, because Stapp was now able to gain subjective impressions of these experiences. And then couple that with the data he was collecting, he was in a really good spot to be able to present some solutions that no one else had ever come up with.
You can imagine the Air Force's reaction, you know, the designer of a high-performance airplane saying, okay, I'm going to be the test pilot.
Right. That didn't happen a lot. But one of the things that Stapp said, Stapp was an incredibly funny man, and he was always laughing, always making jokes. And one of the jokes he made about this, maybe it wasn't completely a joke, but he said, look, I would much rather kill myself on one of these experiments than kill some young captain and then have to go through a court-martial. So he kind of laughed it off, but it was a really very serious thing to get these subjective impressions from a medical professional, and they really helped him put together the solutions that he ended up coming up with that really changed certain components of aircraft design. The Stapp was a gadfly that was constantly trying to force airplane manufacturers to build aircraft that would be safer for pilots.
Right. And that didn't always go so over so well with the Army and then later Air Force brass. I mean, it was mainly about getting his products up in the air, and safety was, I guess, a part of the equation, but it was not always the foremost one.
That's exactly right. And when you have airplane manufacturers saying it doesn't make sense to build a hardened cockpit that's going to be capable of withstanding huge multiples of G-forces if the human body can't handle those forces itself. And at that point, when Stapp began his research project in California, the official line that the Air Force had in their School of Aviation Medicine was that the human body was incapable of withstanding acceleration or deceleration forces beyond 18 times gravity. And so why in the world should an airplane manufacturer build a stronger cockpit or stronger restraint systems if the human body couldn't even take the G-forces? Well, what Stapp wanted to do was, in fact, prove that the human body could withstand much more than 18 Gs. And if he could do that, he could then go to the airplane manufacturers and force them to build safer planes. And that's exactly what happened.
My guest today is Craig Ryan, a nonfiction writer whose new book is titled Sonic Wind, The Story of John Paul Stapp and How a Renegade Doctor Became the Fastest Man on Earth. And that is exactly true. But in the meantime, he also saved hundreds of thousands of lives through his work in developing better safety practices, harnesses. He was one of the pioneer leaders in advocating for seatbelts in automobiles and increasing automobile safety. Helped us learn how to handle high-pressure to low-pressure situations, as we mentioned a couple of times, the bends, whether it be in diving or in high altitude. And he also began to change what we thought were the limits of the human body to take stresses like G-forces. And it's a fascinating book on this history that he brings to play. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We mentioned after the war, he has this lab at Muroc, which would later become Edwards. This is the same place where Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. This is the place where the hottest test pilots were testing the new planes and rocket research later and rocket planes and all that sort of thing was happening out there. And he was doing the same thing on the effects on the human body and building rocket sleds that would propel man, put strong G-forces, brakes, would sort of test all the aspects surrounding this high-performance flight, whether it's ejecting at Mach 1, what would the force be, the acceleration forces, all sorts of questions. And really, it was this no man's land out there, and they were kind of left to their own devices, and that's the way he liked it, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The fact that Stapp could do his work out in the Mojave Desert without having his superiors back at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, looking over his shoulder and questioning him every step of the way, that was, he referred to it as freedom's last stand. Basically, getting away from headquarters, as he referred to them, the men at the mahogany desks. Stapp wanted to get out there in the field with his team and do this work. His biggest desire was that the Air Force would basically leave him alone and let him achieve the breakthroughs that he thought he could get to.
Well, I mentioned Chuck Yeager out there. He was a contemporary of Chuck Yeager, and you tell a story in the book that the night before Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier, he was out riding horses and fell off a horse and broke his ribs. And while you couldn't confirm it, at least the story was that was Dr. Stapp was the one who patched him up.
Well, there were a lot of people that were out at Muroc in those days who believed that that's exactly what happened. However, neither Yeager nor Stapp would ever confirm that. Yeager denied it anytime he was asked about it. Stapp would just simply say no comment. But I think there's a pretty good chance that that is what happened. Stapp was a good friend of Yeager's and was a flight surgeon, so it kind of makes sense that it would go that way. But as you say, I don't have any actual proof of that.
Tell us about his experiments with these rocket-propelled sleds. If anybody saw the last Indiana Jones movie where Indiana Jones is on the rocket sled, this is what we're talking about, this huge, fast acceleration and then a deacceleration.
Yes, and it really stretches the limits of the imagination to try to get a picture of what these experiments were like. But let me just set the scene for you on his final rocket sled ride. This is December 10, 1954. There are 9 rockets on the back of this vehicle that's essentially on a track running across horizontally across the desert. And the rockets fire, and Stapp goes from 0 to 639 miles per hour in 5 seconds. Now, that's hard to kind of process on its own, but the real trick was what happened after that. The rocket sled had a very complex and innovative braking system, and it was able to bring that sled from 639 miles per hour back to zero in 1.3 seconds. And even the Air Force personnel and the contractors that were on site that day and saw this happen said that they almost couldn't believe it even as they watched it. It didn't seem possible. But if you can imagine the violence of going from near Mach 1 speed to zero in less than 2 seconds, it almost just boggles the mind as you try to even process that.
And it was really interesting. Some of his, a lot of his research became a part of the vernacular of how we make planes and automobiles safer. But he also found some interesting results that have never really been implemented. And that's the fact that if you're sitting backwards, like on an airplane or something that's going very fast, you're far more safer than if you were sitting forward.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that just will kind of makes intuitive sense if you think about being slammed into the back of your seat at the moment of deceleration rather than lurching forward against a seatbelt or a harness. It makes sense. And in fact, Stapp's work was successful in getting a number of military transport aircraft to turn the seats around so that in the event of a crash, the passengers on the plane would be slammed into the back of their seats and would have a much greater chance of survival. So Stapp did have an effect there and in other places as well.
But, on passenger aircraft, we still all face forward.
Well, we do, and, you know, Stapp made impassioned pleas to the commercial airline industry to turn the seats around, and the answer he always got was, people want to see where they're going, not where they've been. So we continue to look forward as we sit on these airplanes, but I guarantee you, if one of those airplanes ever ran off the end of the runway and you had a sudden stop, you would wish that your seat was turned around and you were slammed into the back of it instead of lurching forward.
And also, if you ride a train, that sounds like a good, the seats facing backwards is the way to go.
Absolutely, and it just occurred to me the other day that, you know, so many of our school buses don't even have seat belts for the students that ride on those buses. It seems like the least they could do would be to turn those seats around so that in the event of a crash, the students would slam backwards instead of, you know, basically just being thrown forward inside the bus.
What's amazing as you're reading through this book is how often Stapp, while he's doing this research, he's the leader of the team, and yet he's the one taking the risks, which is really interesting in and of itself. Taking enormous risks on his body, you described that last ride where he was going 639 miles an hour. You know, when the people reached him, he was almost a bloody mess.
Oh, the injuries that he suffered on these experiments were tremendous. And one of the things that I hear as I talk to people about Dr. Stapp is they will say, well, he clearly had a suicide wish, or he was a daredevil. And neither of these could be farther from the truth. He was not a daredevil, and he certainly didn't have a suicide wish. In fact, he said more than once that there was nothing he hated more than the moments leading up to one of these experiments, because he said, you know it's going to hurt, you just don't know how much. I mean, he broke ribs and wrists and concussions, lost fillings in his teeth. Probably the most serious injuries that he suffered were to his eyes. That's really the failure point in an experiment like this. And there was a real chance, both Stapp and his team believed, that he might lose his eyesight on that last run. Just tremendous courage. It's one thing to have, you know, a moment of courage, for instance, a soldier in battle throws himself on a hand grenade. You know, we hear about these incredible acts of courage. Stapp's courage was a little different in that he continued to subject himself to these violent experiments time after time after time, knowing what was going to happen to him. So he was referred to by some of his colleagues as the bravest man in the United States Air Force, and I think you could make a case for that.
My guest today is a nonfiction writer, Craig Ryan. His new book is titled Sonic Wind, The Story of John Paul Stapp and How a Renegade Doctor Became the Fastest Man on Earth. Stapp was a pioneering researcher in the effects of heavy G-forces and deacceleration, like in crashes or in ejection seat ejections. Tremendous knowledge on restraints as well. And after the Air Force finally grounded him after that last flight, they said no more of this, he started devoting his work to getting seatbelts in automobiles, and was a leader in looking at how to reduce the number of fatalities in auto accidents. He always compared to what happened with the FAA when you had the board that investigates all airplane crashes, in the NTSB, and said we needed something like that for highway crashes, or at least somebody that was doing research. And he was tremendously instrumental in the passage of legislation which led to that and saved lots and lots of lives.
Yeah, really, the 1960s, which brought us this legislation that created the Department of Transportation and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, that all came from work that both Stapp and Ralph Nader did in the Congress, testifying over and over to try to convince our politicians that we needed some kind of national attention to car crashes. And where it really began for Stapp was the revelation that, this was back in the 1950s, that more of our Air Force fighter pilots were dying in car crashes on the ground than they were in aircraft accidents. And so he really went after this and had a huge effect. Lyndon Johnson signed these landmark auto safety legislation bills in 1966, and the numbers of victims of car crashes began to fall almost immediately. And I think that there's absolutely no doubt that the U.S. auto industry would not have gone this way voluntarily. In fact, they spent many, many millions of dollars fighting this legislation. And so you have to give a lot of credit to Stapp for sticking with this and keeping the heat on the U.S. auto industry. He had a huge impact.
Yeah. Now he died in 1999, but you actually had spoken with him in the last decade of his life, and in one of the chapters you use as an epigraph, a complete conversation that you had with him. Could you recount that for us?
Yeah, and it was something that happened again and again after I met Stapp. He was just such an unusual man and very intellectually generous, and he was always just reaching out to people he knew, people he'd met, and he would call me, and my phone would ring. I'd pick it up. And you never knew what you were going to hear. I was at work one day. The phone rang. I picked it up, and I'll give you the entire transcript of this conversation, Rich. It went just like this: Ryan, Stapp here. The worth of a scientist can be measured by the degree to which he's willing to do battle with the savages and cannibals of management. Good day. Click. And that's the conversation. And, you know, you would get one of these from Stapp, and the first thing you'd do would be to reach for a pencil to try to write it down so you wouldn't forget it, because every one of these seemed like they were just little jewels. And I wished I'd been able to write down more of them than I was.
Well, in fact, some people credit him with a version of Murphy's Law. And another one, there is a Stapp's Law, or the Stapp's Ironic Paradox, which is the universal aptitude for ineptitude makes any human accomplishment an incredible miracle. Now, did he really say that?
He did. He not only said it, but Stapp was constantly coming up with puns or jingles or little haikus, and he jotted them down on the backs of napkins and sales receipts, whatever he had with him, and he would keep these. And in the later years of his life, after he was retired, he published a couple of books that collected all of these little sayings that he would come up with. And some of them are just hysterical, and some of them are actually very incisive and interesting. He invented his own calendar. He invented a 13-month calendar, which he claimed was he called it his rational calendar, far more rational than the Gregorian calendar, with months of different numbers of days, and the same, you know, January 7th is on a different day of the week each year. Stapp thought that was crazy, so he invented his own calendar and actually came up with one of his little sayings for each day of the year.
He's a really remarkable man, and what's really interesting is he's had such an effect on us, and 99.9% of the people of the world don't have any idea who John Paul Stapp was.
And I hope that this book can help remedy that, because he's someone whose name I think we need to know, and my greatest hope would be that at some point in the future, another writer would come along and come up with a different version of this story, find some things that I wasn't able to find. I think Stapp is worth it, and I'm really glad to know that, you know, some people are now meeting Stapp through this book that never would have known about it.
The name of the book is Sonic Wind. Craig Ryan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Craig Ryan is the author of acclaimed books on extreme adventure and scientific discovery. His latest book is titled Sonic Wind, the story of John Paul Stapp and how a renegade doctor became the fastest man on Earth. It's published by LiveRight. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.